From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for the first day of July 2022. It's also the second weekend of Summerfest, and your Milwaukee Brewers are home this weekend with the Pirates before heading south to play the Cubs. The Supreme Court of Ohio indefinitely suspended an Ohio attorney for repeatedly driving naked and exposing himself to other drivers. It seems like he could have avoided that suspension if he had just borrowed a robe from one of the judges. A man in Denmark was arrested by the cops three times in the same day. The first time was to make sure he attended his court hearing. The second time was for stealing from 7-Eleven after his court hearing. And the third time was for riding a scooter on a pier into a lake. That sounds like a pretty full day to me, even if you're not crazy. French's, the people that bring you mustard and ketchup, bring you just in time for summer ketchup-flavored popsicles. But they're only available in Canada. Thank goodness Canadian summers are short. Also from the Great White North, eh? A man ate his own underwear in order to beat a breathalyzer test. I hope that didn't work. And finally, here's a reason not to go to New Hampshire ever. The invasive green crab is wreaking havoc up and down the New England coast. So in an effort to rid themselves of the crabs, a local distillery is peddling crab trapper-infused whiskey. It's described as briny with a fireball finish. That doesn't sound any better than that guy's underwear. On the podcast today, we have Steve Giles, Chris Evers, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Max. No Florida stories today, but it feels like there was one in there somewhere. You know, I think as we close out the end of the second quarter here, get to the halfway point of the year, or worth maybe just doing a bit of a retrospective on what we've gotten through so far. Certainly, plenty as we look ahead as well then for the second half of this year. Just numbers-wise, as you look at the first half, the NASDAQ down 29.2%, a pretty incredible decline on an index that really for the better part of the last 5 years had been the piece that had really been kind of the shining star of, you know, the various things we look at. The S&P 500 down 20%. Including dividends down 20% as you look at the first half of the year, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 14.4% through the first half. Again, I think highlighting how some of the higher quality names have held up a bit better, but certainly no real place to hide in the stock market. Obviously the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury significantly higher than where we ended 2021. Started the year at 1.51%. Up 146 basis points so far this year to close at 2.97. I think a really important place to start, perhaps. We had been considerably higher on the 10-year yield, almost touching 3.5% back middle of June. Really, Chris, on this conversation that continues to happen regarding inflation. Certainly, we have had pressure from the inflationary perspective and forcing the Fed's hand on interest rates far, far faster than what we had predicted earlier in the year. It's allowed rates to move higher, and that creates all kinds of problems for investors.
Yeah, I think if we could summarize the first 6 months of the year by one word, I think we would say inflation, right? And everything's been downstream from that. So these high levels of inflation that we've had for the first half of the year has driven to the higher interest rates. Those higher interest rates have put pressure on bond prices and stocks. You know, the last 2 months, as we've seen, as you said, the 10-year Treasury move from up to 3.5, down a little bit to closing just a little bit below 3% today. You know, we might say that part of the story there has been, the narrative moving from, the baton moving from inflation to potential recession as essentially a change in narrative, and the 10-year Treasury rate coming down a little bit based on that. So without a doubt, I'd say these first 6 months, inflation has told the story and touched just about every asset price out there.
Well, and so some of this needs to be a let's look at what has happened, right? And certainly I think, as you look at your portfolio, you look at the correlation between stocks and bonds this year, that's essentially been one, right? That as stocks have gone down, bonds have gone down. You know, Steve, perhaps encouraging the last couple of weeks, all of a sudden, it appears bonds are doing a bit of what we would have come to expect from them, right? That, you know, bonds play a different role in our portfolio than maybe what we've seen so far this year, but all of a sudden, you know, the importance of balance comes back into focus.
Yeah, whenever the stock market goes down as much as it has, I mean, consider that we haven't seen this big of a drop in the first half of a year since 1970, Kyle. Bonds start to look that much more appealing. For a long time, investors have been rewarded with higher than average returns on the stock market because yields in fixed income have been so low. But now that the Fed has been driving up rates, the bond market has been rewarding those investors with higher yields across the board, and it has gotten the attention of investors looking to diversify away from those riskier asset classes.
Joel, we got a couple of updates this week on gross domestic product. I think as importantly on inflation, the GDP number, obviously a first quarter number pointing to an economy that was in decline, at least in the first quarter. You look at projections for second quarter gross domestic product. The Atlanta Fed published something recently that shows that perhaps we're still in decline here in the second quarter. But we've learned quite a bit, you know, this week about the GDP and in particular the PCE number, the personal consumption expenditure.
Right. The gross domestic product number, as you said, that, you know, goes through March. So it's old news and it's the third estimate. So it's just fine tuning with more information, you know, two estimates before that. And yeah, it showed decline. And a lot of that decline came from an imbalance between exports and imports, which is reflecting that the global wealth is still sort of out of sync and still recovering from all of the shipping problems and whatnot because of the pandemic, and so really if you think through the end of March, we're not even really seeing much of those interest rate increases yet. So to say that we were sinking already in the first 3 months, and then the interest rates have started to go up, it'll be interesting to see what we have. But the PCE numbers, the personal consumption expenditures, that's a really key number to look at. We get monthly updates on those, and we got the most recent one on Thursday, and it's showing us that inflation is still high. It's the highest it's been since the early 1980s, but that, you know, there may be signs, and it's hard to sort of see trends yet because it's still early, but we're seeing that there are some signs that maybe inflation has peaked. Again, it's still too early. The main number that the Fed looks at, the Federal Reserve Board that they look at when they're considering inflation, is the PCE index. And in May, that was up 6.3%. And it's been at 6.3% for 2 months in a row. In April, it was 6.6%, so it's down from that. And in April, that was the highest it's been since 1982. And then if you take out the big volatile parts of PCE, of inflation, and that's food and energy prices, if you look at that at a monthly basis, it's at 0.3% a month for the last 4 months in a row. So that's also maybe indicating that, you know, maybe we've hit peak inflation, and maybe some of these things that the Fed is doing to raise interest rates to try to slow the economy, maybe that stuff is starting to work.
Yeah, but unfortunately, Joel, for most consumers and most investors, those two most volatile components that you're referencing, food and energy, is what we're most attuned to.
That's right. And, you know, we've talked about this before, too, especially gasoline, where, you know, there aren't many things that you consume that has signs all over the place telling you how much it is. So it's very much in your face, you know, how much gas costs and how much it's going up.
And I think household purchasers, right, if you're the one that runs to the grocery store for your family, you tend to see those prices pretty regularly as well. And so not only are they the things that tend to impact us most, you know, week to week, month to month, they're also the things we're most attuned to as far as prices. So I think I'm sensitive to you know, what the longer term direction is, core PCE or core CPI. I think the right way to think about long term, of course, you know, us as consumers, you know, Steve rightfully points out, we don't get to strip out the things that are part of the larger spending basket. I think the other thing that's worth pointing out is that we're hearing more and more from retailers just how much inventory they have on hand. And so, you know, we've talked for a while about this transition from goods-based spending to more services-based spending. You know, we could start to see a pretty significant shift in some of the inflationary measures on the goods side, right? It's the delivery delays for the couch you wanted to buy, the car you wanted to buy, whatever it is. They're starting to come down. At the same time, we're hearing more and more about flight delays and cancellations. It's more difficult, you know, to rent cars and to find hotel rooms. And so, you know, we may see that inflation number transition to some different areas of the market, even as overall disinflation or the rate of inflation slowing, you know, being the broader trend. And so always nuance to this, always things to look at.
If you think of some of the things that have been disrupting our economy in the last couple of years, the pandemic chiefly, but, you know, even more recent things like the war in Ukraine, and the disruption is like, you know, taking a glass of water and shaking it up, and it takes a while for it to settle out. And so, you know, when we look at these numbers month to month, you know, we see that volatility and we feel that, and it takes a while to settle down, and you don't know yet, yeah, how it's going to balance out between goods buying and services buying.
And I think what's so interesting about this conversation, and Chris, this is something you and I have talked about quite a bit, is, you know, the Fed is trying to slow the economy. They are trying to bring prices down by putting some check on the demand that's out there right now. Clearly, supply has been a big part of the problem. But one way you deal with inadequate supply is just to reduce demand. And that's part of what the Fed is doing. We're starting to see that impact now in some raw materials, things like copper prices, things like cotton prices, which have come down pretty substantially, even oil prices that have come down pretty substantially from kind of earlier June peaks.
Yeah, we're seeing definitely demand come down a little bit, and you're seeing that work its way through into commodity prices, like you've mentioned. You know, other things that you know, we've talked about in the past was shipping rates, right? How much does it cost to ship a 40-foot container from Shanghai to L.A.? Well, that number is down north of 30% right now, right? So that tells you, okay, goods being shipped across the Pacific, costs are coming down there because we have less demand for goods. You're seeing things like inventory of chips in South Korea, which is obviously a major producer of microprocessors, up over 40% in terms of the amount of chips they have on inventory. So you're seeing that massive switch in terms of demand, you know, from goods-based to services-based. You're seeing travel almost back to pre-pandemic levels, and that's almost entirely based on leisure travel. I mean, if you look at business travel, that's still down 20% from pre-pandemic. So think in mind of how much leisure travel is out there. So consumers have shifted all of that spending from the goods side to the services side almost all instantaneously as once, right? And it's kind of rare to have that occur where all consumers are making a similar decision at once and hoarding essentially into the similar types of goods and services. So we're definitely seeing that come down in goods prices. You saw that in the May reading, a decrease in goods spending and actually an increase in services spending. And that's a trend likely to continue through much of the summer while the consumer is sitting on a lot of cash.
So Steve, in light of, you know, potentially the rate of growth that has already slowed, may continue to slow if the Fed has their way, in light of the fact that, you know, Treasury yields have run as high as they have, that there's some opportunity potentially now in bonds, right? I think that's the piece that's being missed in all this. You go back to the 10-year return for your average intermediate bond fund, right? Maybe if you're lucky, it got 1.5 or 2%. But you know, a balanced portfolio probably got 7 or 8%. And so most of your return was coming from the stock component. Well, all of a sudden, you know, if you've still got that same balance, maybe you don't get 14% from stocks anymore the way we did the last 10, but maybe you don't need it because bonds can contribute more than they have.
Yeah, for a long time, we have been reminding clients that there is such a thing as regression to the mean, and they're going to be continually reminded of that as we move forward here. This overperformance of stocks for the last decade is not going to last, Kyle. And this underperformance from bonds also is not going to last. Bonds have, for the last decade, underperformed. Stocks have overperformed. This idea that a 60-40 balanced portfolio was all of a sudden useless because the 40% in bonds wasn't generating the kind of returns that investors had grown accustomed to in the past might be becoming more in fashion as bond yields increase. And I think of a time when my parents were saving in the 80s and the 90s when bond yields were up near 7, 8, 9%. Of course, we all have those stories from our parents and grandparents when they were able to lock in their mortgages at 12% on a 30-year fixed. I mean, those days obviously are long gone. But the point here is that a model asset allocation portfolio has to be flexible. And as much as in the 80s, investors that were retiring were told to have 60% of their money in fixed income because interest rates were so high, and now people are shifting from what might have been a 70% allocation towards stocks, hey, be ready for bonds to take up a much bigger percentage. And it's also a good reminder that the best retirement portfolio plan is one that is flexible, that can be accommodative to what's happening in the broader economy.
And what I appreciate so much about those comments, Steve, is, you know, I think they paint the exact picture of where we've been and where we're going, right? That rates were very low, and that meant that the future earnings of stocks looked more attractive. You were more willing to pay for those future earnings because you didn't have to discount them as much. It's a concept we've talked about quite a bit. It also meant that bonds were a little less attractive because the yield just wasn't there. Well, we're in an environment now where, you know, maybe earnings growth will be a little bit slower than what we've seen in the last 10 years. Maybe the interest rate component is a little bit higher, making those earnings even less attractive. And Chris, you know, I think Steve rightfully points out, but I know it's a conversation you and I have, if the vast majority of what you should expect from bonds is yield, well, okay, that paints a picture for bonds that's more attractive. And the converse of that is, because for stocks, all that matters is earnings and interest rates, it paints a picture for stocks where potentially they're a little less attractive. But again, all in the right proportions.
Yeah, without a doubt, the best way to estimate what your long-term return on a bond portfolio is what's the current yield when you purchase that portfolio. And for the last, let's call it 6 to 7 years, a lot of the times you were buying a bond portfolio that was paying a yield somewhere in the 1.5% to 2% range. Right? That's kind of a fair estimate for what you're going to make. Maybe not what the historic average was, but based on the yield that you purchased that bond investment at, that seems like a fair estimate. Now, you know, if the 10-year treasury is at 3% and you buy corporate bonds, you might be looking at something closer to 3 to 3.5% in terms of the yield on a bond portfolio. As an investor, you know, I like to think of interest rates and your decision between what you're buying as, you know, competition for your cash, right? I have cash. Where am I going to put it? Well, if I could get this level of 3.5% return on what I would consider a safer investment, maybe I'm going to demand a better rate of return on stocks to purchase them, right? So that has pushed the values of stocks down because people are saying, well, I need prices to be down to justify that when I'm able to generate a respectable level of return and more safe investments. So I think we all sit around this table as we build portfolios and look and say, well, how can we construct a portfolio that's going to reach somebody's goals in retirement to generate the cash flow they need with as little risk as possible? Well, in a higher interest rate environment, which we're, you know, entering or have entered, it makes our job a little easier of saying, well, we don't have to rely so much on that stock component because the bonds are going to provide some level of returns for us going forward as well.
And I do think it is important, and you point this out, Chris, these are both moving targets. You know, the 10-year started the year below 2%. We're now just below 3%. Well, the earnings yield on stocks, as much as they have the market's come down, so that's pushed the yield up, the yield is still about twice what we're getting on the 10-year treasury. With an earnings yield near 6 and a 10-year near 3, you know, that dollar that you have to invest, you're going to do about twice as well in an earnings yield as you are a 10-year treasury. But in a weakening economy, that earnings yield could get further diluted as earnings get revised downward. In an environment where the Fed continues to raise interest rates, that 10-year treasury number is going to get higher. And as those numbers get closer, you have to ask yourself the question, how much more of a premium am I willing to pay for stocks to generate that extra return longer term. And that's where consistently having conversations with your advisor about the appropriate allocation for your portfolio based upon your needs is so important.
You know, I think all of this gets back to kind of this idea of what we see coming, right? That, you know, everybody wants to know, okay, when's the market going to finally bottom? When's the market going to peak so we can sell on the other direction, right? And I think the reality is that those are maybe the wrong questions to be asking. The right questions are exactly what you're talking about, because the earlier questions are the ones that don't have great answers.
You know, Kyle, I find it interesting that everybody's waiting for the shoe to drop with respect to when that recession is going to start. We may be living through one right now. Obviously, we all know that the first quarter GDP numbers got revised, now a negative 1.6% contraction in the first quarter. Who's to say what those numbers might look like for the second quarter? And we all know the technical definition of a recession is two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. For all of our listeners out there that are wondering when the recession is going to start, hey, it may have already started, which to me is actually kind of a sigh of relief. If we've gotten the recession over with, all we got to do is just look forward to the market recovering from here.
And Steve, that's just sort of a thumbnail description of when a recession happens. Officially, it's a bunch of academic economists who get together and look at all sorts of things and decide sometimes months after we're out of a recession when we're in a recession.
Correct.
So, yeah.
Well, and let's be clear that the stock market is a leading indicator. And so if the expectation is that growth is slowing, and I think if you look at any of the data we've seen, especially near the very end of this half of the year, you know, it's pointing to expectations that the economy is slowing, whether that's commodity prices, whether that's the market response. And so I think, you know, the reality is while investors may not have priced in the full extent of recession, the full extent of slow growth, we've already begun to price in some of it. And so just because we get that official announcement from the National Bureau of Economic Research, just because we get some sign that, well, now we're in it, and oh no, remember, of course, we may be out of it by the time we even know we're in it. And remember that stocks have already priced in a lot of that pain. You know, I think just a quick roundup here before we close for this quarter, for this half year. You know, Chris, as far as, you know, what we've come through, I think we've talked about that pretty clearly, but there's plenty to look ahead to. What kinds of things are on your radar as we enter the second half, Eric?
Well, what I'm thinking about is, you know, what really matters to investors is what your return is over the next 10, 15, 20 years, right? That's really what matters to your level of success. But I think all of us, including probably us sitting around the table, the temptation is to think, well, I want to make sure I make the right decision today about where the market's going. Right. And you're always thinking, OK, well, 3 to 6 months, is the market bottom? Are we near the point where it makes sense to buy? Well, the obvious answer, if you really are thinking about 15, 20 years, because that's what matters, does it matter if you bought 5 or 10% too early or that you didn't time it perfectly? So that's what I'm thinking about right now, is trying to reset that perspective of, you know, yeah, you're going to feel stupid if you bought early and the market slides another 5 or 10%. You're not going to remember that 10, 15, 20 years from now. And that's what actually really matters. So that's what I'm kind of thinking about as we go into the back end of the year.
Chris, I couldn't agree more. I've invested a lot of money over the last few weeks for clients that do have that longer term perspective. And obviously, the longer your time horizon, the better that deal is going to look.
Well, I think those are wise words. Obviously, a focus not just on what the next 6 months bring, but what, you know, the reality of investment success is. As always, we enjoy doing the program for you. We look forward to talking to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.